Yes. Okay. Joining us right now on PMP Network is one of my favorite singers from the 1960s and early 70s. This guy had like more hits than anybody. He was the charts. Tommy Rowe, you might remember him for songs like Sheila and Dizzy, which was number one in 1969 for tons of weeks. It sold like 10 million records. And my favorite Tommy Rowe song, actually, is a song called It's Now Winter's Day. I love that song. It's really cool. And you can find me singing it sometimes in the shower. you all know that from watching the great YouTube video of me singing in the shower. But that's another story. Well, Tommy is joining us right now. He's written a book. It's called Cabbage Town to Tinseltown and Places in Between. It's a really cool book. And there's a lot of stuff I want to go over. So let's welcome Tommy right now to PMP Network. How are you, Tommy?
I'm great, Mark. It's good to be with you.
It's great to have you here. Now, let's. There's so many things I want to talk to you about, and there's also things that people wanted to ask about. So let's just start off with here. With you started out in Atlanta. You're a Southern kid. And when you first went into the recording studio, I love this part of the book, you go in and you're actually using Elvis Presley's microphone. You're using the Jordanaires singers, his singers for backup. And it seems like at this point in your life, you could become a country singer or maybe the new Buddy Holly, a rockabilly star. That's what it looked like at that point.
Well, you know, that was when I look back on that, it's really funny because I was so nervous anyway to be at 20 years old going to Nashville to record my first big session. And then when they started telling me I was singing on Elvis Presley's microphone, well, my knees really started knocking. Huge fan of Elvis, of course. And the Jordanaires were singing background for me, which was they were on all of Elvis's records. And I was recording in the RCA studio where Elvis made his hit. So, I mean, I don't know how much more pressure one kid could take, but I managed to get through it, and somehow I came out with my first number one record out of that.
It was unbelievable. But the funny thing is, and again, maybe it's not so funny, but reading the book, it's interesting. I didn't know that you had recorded Sheila before that for a different record label owned by Sam Phillips from Sun's brother, the Judd label, I guess. And it did nothing in the first time around. So it must be really strange to first of all, and reading the book, it also indicated that initially you didn't like that version, the second version, as much as the first. But all of a sudden, this thing went nuts. You're making money. You're hitting number one. Hey, you can't argue with success, right?
Well, that's true. And it was Felton's idea to, when I recorded the first version, I was still in high school. And I recorded it with my high school band. And it was just regular 2/4 drums on the record. Well, it was Felton's idea to put in the Buddy Holly drum sound, you know, and do a tribute to Buddy Holly. That was his whole idea, which I wasn't really happy with that idea. But, you know, you don't have much say-so. In those days, we didn't have any say-so about our records. I mean, we kind of did what the boss said to do, you know.
Right.
So when we recorded the song, we did what they call a split session, where they would record two artists on one three-hour session, and each artist was supposed to get like an hour and a half time to do their two songs. So the other artist on the session was Marvin Benefil, who was an Elvis sound-alike, of all things. And so Marvin took like 2 hours to do two songs. So I was left with 30 minutes to do my two songs. And Save Your Kisses was supposed to be the A-side, so we cut Save Your Kisses first. And we spent 25 minutes on that. So we were left with 5 minutes to do Sheila. And we ran it down and did it in one take. Well, when I left the studio, I was just totally unhappy with Sheila. I just knew Sheila was, I didn't even want it to be a B-side. You know, I thought it was just not a good record at all. So they released the record, and Save Your Kisses is the A-side. They promote it. It gets a little airplay here and there, but it doesn't take off. And there's a DJ in Baltimore, Maryland, named Buddy Dean, who was a big DJ at the time, had his own dance show, kind of like American Bandstand, Dick Clark's American Bandstand, locally there in Baltimore. So he flipped the record over and started playing Sheila. And as we used to say in the old days, the phones lit up. People started calling, requesting the song. So it broke out of Baltimore, became a number one record in Baltimore. And out of that area, it spread all over the United States. Next thing I knew, it's number one in England. And so the song, which I hated when we recorded it, turned out to be my first big record. So you never know, man. I mean, who am I to say if I wasn't happy with it? If people liked it, maybe it was a good version after all.
So meanwhile, I'm reading in the book, and I'm thinking, this guy's got a number one hit. He must be traveling the country promoting it. And initially, you were working with GE. You had a solid job with them, and you didn't want to leave.
Well, that's true. My cousin had got me the job, Jackie Densmore, and he really laid some markers down to get me this job. It was really hard back at that time to get a good job, and GE was a big company, and you could figure you'd have a good career there if you did well. So I was only there for about 6 months when Sheila started taking off and started climbing up the Billboard charts. So I would get these calls from my promoter, that produced the record, Bill Lowry. He'd call me at work and say, you know, Tommy, you need to think about quitting your job because it looks like Sheila's going to be a big record. And I would always say no. You know, I wasn't about to quit my job. I just landed. So he would laugh. And finally, he called me one afternoon and said, you know, told me to come by his office when I got off work and we need to discuss the idea of quitting my job. So when I got off, I went by his office, and he was still pushing me to quit the job. I was saying no, and he was having a good time with me, having a big laugh. So he leaned back in his chair, and he said, I tell you what, I'll write you a check against an advance against royalties for $5,000, and maybe that'll help you change your mind. Well, you know, $5,000 in 1962 was like $100,000 today, and more than I made in a year at General Electric. So I was stunned by that, and he told me to go home, talk to my parents about it. And so I took the check home with me and showed it to my parents, and they talked it over and said, look, you know, you're 20 years old. Quit your job. Jackie won't get upset with you. And, you know, go out and see if it'll work for you. So I did. Next thing I knew, I was on tour with Sam Cooke. My first national tour. So it all happened very fast for me at a very young age. So in a way, I was learning as I was going, you know, because I'd never performed professionally before. And so I had to learn how to perform, how to write songs, and the whole thing very early age.
Yeah, well, I mean, I just can't believe reading this book. I didn't realize all the things that you did at an early age. Now, you actually went into the Army Reserves?
I did. I got my draft notice in 1960, the latter part of 63. And when the Beatles came to America and they did the Ed Sullivan Show, they did their first American concert February 11th, 1964, in Washington, D.C., and Brian Epstein had asked my manager if I would open the show for them, which I did. Well, right after that, in the spring of 64, I went into boot camp at Fort Jackson, South Carolina. And so for the whole year of 64, I was out of the business. But in a way, it was good for me because during 64 is when Beatlemania took off and the British invasion really took over the Billboard charts. I mean, all the British acts were releasing records in the States, and they were pushing the American acts off the charts. So while I was doing my boot camp time, Fort Sam Houston and Fort Lewis, Washington, it gave me time to figure out how I would go into the studio to compete with these guys. Mm-hmm. So I wrote Sweet Pea while I was in boot camp. And my idea was to do something so different, do what I called at the time soft rock, which turned into be bubblegum. It was called bubblegum music. Mm-hmm. But I wrote Sweet Pea, and when I got out, I recorded it, and it was a big record for me. So I started the new genre of bubblegum music with that. And it kept me in the charts. I went from rockabilly. I was considered a rockabilly artist before that with Sheila and everybody. And so I went from rockabilly to bubblegum. And I think being able to write those bubblegum songs is what kept me in the charts for the decade of the 60s.
Wow. I that's a very catchy tune. Oh, Sweet Pea.
Yeah.
Won't you be? I mean, you know, it just, I can hear it boom in my head. And Tommy, you skipped over something I got to talk about. Because you opened for the Beatles. You opened Beatles, their first concert ever in America, February 11th, 1964. What was that like? Did you get to know them? Were you friends with them?
Well, I had toured with them in England before in 1963, so I already knew them.
Wow.
And they opened for us in England. And they were featured act on Chris Montez, and I were the headliners of our tour in England. And the Beatles were a featured act. They were just starting their career in 1963, they were developing a big fan base. So mm-hmm. we knew each other, and I had struck up a relationship with Brian Epstein. He wanted to manage me in England and in Europe, and he was talking to my manager about handling my career over there. And, you know, you think back on this, Brian nor the Beatles, they didn't have a clue what was in store for them. I mean, they were just young guys like myself trying to make a name for themselves and have hit records, you know. Mm-hmm. They had no idea what was in store. So when they got the opportunity to do Ed Sullivan's show, they also booked that one show in Washington, D.C., and Brian got in touch with my manager and asked if I would open the show for them. So I did. You know, I mean, we were buddies and we were mates and we knew each other, and I was happy to be a part of it. But the relationship with the Beatles started in 1963. In fact, you know, there's an interesting story about John Lennon's Gibson guitar. You know, that guitar sold for $2.4 million last year at auction. And I started writing Everybody on his guitar. I asked John one day if I could borrow his guitar to finish the song I was working on called Everybody. And he said, of course. And he pulled it from the luggage rack and handed it to me, and I finished the song. So I like to joke with people now that the guitar's got to be worth at least $3 million since I wrote Everybody on it, right?
Well, I wouldn't have known that, but I read your book, and it's in there. So it's a fascinating thing. Now, I got to ask you a question because I have like 40 questions from listeners, but I'm going to only do a couple of them because I have all my own stuff to ask too.
But, thank you.
someone actually wrote, her name is Jean, and she said she remembered a episode of Green Acres where you played a character called Tadpole. And I asked her if she was actually having a hallucinogenic experience, but I know the answer because I read your book.
Yeah. No, I did Green Acres. I played a character called Tadpole Talbot, and Tadpole is a country singer who comes through town, and he takes Eb on the road with him, you know, which kind of steals him from Eddie Albert and Eva Gabor from the farm there, their farmhand, Eb. And so Eb goes on the road with me, and he gets tired of the road and comes back home. But that was a fun experience for me, and I tell you, the thing that I was thrilled with was getting to meet Pat Buttram, you know, because I'd watched Pat Buttram when I was a child in cowboy movies, you know, so I knew who he was, and I remembered him in like all these Gene Autry movies and Tom Mix and all these movies. So when I met Pat Buttram, you know, we're all fans to some extent, you know, and I told him I was a huge fan of his, and he was such a nice guy. Everybody on that show was super nice. Eddie Albert, professional. Eva Gabor, very professional. And the show is a lot of fun. It still runs to this day. I mean, I see it on TV a lot now. It's called The Four of Clubs. I think it's The Four of Clubs.
Yeah. It's around. But, in fact, I think it might be on YouTube, actually.
Yeah, it is on YouTube. Yeah. Right. It is. Yeah.
It's interesting. And you mentioned earlier about creating soft rock, which was called at the time Bubblegum, and they kind of labeled you as the King of Bubblegum. Did you take that as an insult, or did you embrace it?
Well, at first I did, because it was kind of a slap in the face. It was because, you know, if you think about the 60s music, it was a lot of it was heavy metal, a lot of it was protest songs, and the genre, and of course the Beatlemania with all the British rock stuff. So my music really stood out. I mean, it was soft. And but actually, the reason it was successful, I believe, was because it was so different than everything else, and it was also safe for the DJs. I mean, a lot of people don't realize it, but in the 60s, the DJs had to be careful what they played on the air, or they'd lose their license. And so they were very reluctant to play songs that were over 3 minutes long and songs that had any kind of controversial lyric content to it. Yeah. It's totally different than from today. You know, today that's in the groove, you know. But so I think that was really a good thing for me. And then after Sweet Pea, you know, I write in the book about Hanky Panky, Tommy James and the Shondells. They released that in 1964, and it did nothing. After Sweet Pea became a hit, they re-released it, and that started Tommy's career, you know, with the soft rock sound, because he had a lot of kind of bubblegum records, too, in the beginning.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it was good for a lot of us, because it gave us a sound that we could do and compete, and that was different from everything else on the radio.
Well, without Tommy Rowe, there wouldn't have been the Ohio Express and 1910 Fruitland Company and all the rest of
it. Yeah, and most of those records were recorded by studio bands. You know, they weren't really, you know, they weren't artists as such. But I mean, with me, I mean, that's who I was. You know, Sweet Pea and Dizzy, Hooray for Hazel, all those songs.
You know, it's interesting. We mentioned before about you quitting GE, and I guess you were worried about something that every singer worries about, and that is being like a one-hit wonder with when you had Sheila hitting number one. But again, you have one different thing than most of these others. You write your own songs. And I think that was the reason why that never should have even been an occurrence to think about it, you know?
Well, of course, at the time, I didn't realize the importance of songwriting. I knew I just loved to write songs, and I did it, you know, like I say today, it's part of my DNA. It's just something I do. But if I hadn't been able to write my own material, I'm sure I would have suffered the charts, the negativity of the charts, just like the other American artists, because a lot of the American artists at the time did not write their own material. They had to depend on, you know, the Brill Building in New York for all of their material. Mm-hmm. So songwriting was the key for me. I was able to make my own sound and kind of maneuver around the charts and make things different for myself.
You know, I mentioned as we started this interview that my favorite song of yours is It's Now Winter's Day. And based on the book here, that was originally titled It's Now Christmas Day?
That's true, yeah. I started writing that while I was living in New York. And I was trying to write a Christmas song, and that was it. I mean, I wrote it as It's Now Christmas Day. And I moved out to California, finished writing on the at Malibu on the beach. It's kind of interesting from cold weather to warm weather to finish that song. But the record label didn't like the idea of pigeonholing the song for a Christmas song, so it was their idea to change the title to It's Now Winter's Day, which is probably a good idea because it's something that could be played, you know, most any time during the year.
I'm just wondering, though, if they had left it the way it was, would that song now be one of the ones you'd hear every single year? I think the answer is yes.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, you never know. I mean, I fought for it. I tried to keep it It's Now Christmas Day because I really wanted a Christmas song. You know, I wanted to write a Christmas song, and that was my first attempt. So, but, you know, back in those days, the artists didn't have much say about what they did. I mean, the label really dictated your choices of songs, you know, your image, everything about you as a young artist. You know, the teen idol thing, you know, they really pushed that. And so it's not like today where today, you know, the artist can kind of call their own shots, you know, which is good in some respects and maybe not so good in other respects. It's hard to say.
Yeah, well, it's obviously things have changed. And one of the things that I was thinking about this when I was listening to It's Now Winter's Day, because I was prepping for this interview, so I listened to your greatest hits because I love the music. And one of the lines of that song was, you know, record tables turning.
Yeah, which we don't
so
have.
They don't really. Yeah. So I'm thinking that you could change it to tender music streaming.
Yeah, you know, I have actually thought about that, you know. That's a good idea. Tender music or soft music streaming, something like that.
Yeah.
That would work. Yeah. Very good. I'll file that away.
It might be working. You know, you just mentioned about how the companies kind of own you. There's a possibility that, by the way, we're speaking with Tommy Rowe. There's a possibility I'd be speaking with Tommy Caviar.
Oh boy, that was an incident that was really unbelievable. It was like my first meeting in New York City with the executives, you know, and they weren't happy with my name. They didn't think Tommy Rowe was a good stage name, and at least some of the executives there didn't. And the idea was to actually change my name to Tommy Caviar, if you can believe this. I mean, when I heard that, of course, 20-year-old kid, I didn't have a clue what caviar was. I knew what catfish were. I ate so much catfish when I was a kid that the thought of it makes me want to throw up now, you know. But Tommy Caviar, I had no idea what caviar was, but I didn't like the sound of it anyway. I mean, the sound of caviar just didn't ring a bell with me. So I fought it. It's one of the battles that I was able to win, you know, with Felton's help and Bill Lowry's help. We resisted that all the way. Thank goodness we won that one.
I'm glad, too. I'm glad. I'd rather be talking to Tommy Rowe than Tommy Caviar. This is me anyway, I guess.
Yeah, can you imagine 55 years in the business? I've been in the business for 55 years, having to go through that many years with that name.
Now, for a while in your life, you lived in the UK, right?
Well, everybody thought I did. The press said I did because I was over there so much working, you know, in the latter part of 63 and right before I went into boot camp, I did a tour over there as well. So the press said I'd moved to England, moved to London, but actually I didn't you know, actually moved there. I just was there a lot, and the press started saying that.
So Jane asked me to ask you about your last hit, which hit number 8 in the United States. It was called Jim Up and Jelly Tight. She wanted to know what it was about.
Well, Jim Up and Jelly Tight is a saying that I used to hear as a kid growing up from my dad. And most of my uncles, they all use that expression. Like we will say groovy or out of sight. That's what they use. They'd say, I remember my dad, we'd be driving along, and he'd see a pretty girl walking down the street, and he'd say, son, that young lady is jam up and jelly tight. So anything like a good meal, he'd lean back in his chair and say, Mom, that was jam up and jelly tight. So yeah. It was just an expression, that a southern expression that I heard, and it actually came from when they do the preserves, you know, in the old days they would can the jams and the jellies and they'd put them up, and when they'd put them up, they'd say everything's jam up and jelly tight, and that came from the south like that.
That's cool. See, she's a northerner, so am I, so that explains that well. You know, you have been elected to the Georgia Music Hall of Fame, the Rockabilly Hall of Fame, the Iowa Rock and Roll Association Hall of Fame. Would it be nice? How about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in where is it, in Ohio or something?
Cleveland, yeah.
Cleveland, yeah.
Yeah, in Cleveland.
Is any chance of that ever happening, you think?
You know, I haven't figured out yet how they pick the folks to go in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And it's not something that I really should concentrate on, I guess. But, of course, you know, any time that you're honored for your talent or for your successes through your career, it's a wonderful feeling, you know, to be, especially by your peers. But I'll leave it to those who make those decisions to, you know, decide if they want me in there or not. Hopefully, if they do decide they want me in there, it'll happen not posthumously, you know.
But, yeah, I understand. Well, I'm gonna put a little bit of a plug out there as we promote this all over the country.
That's great.
Because I think it's something that's deserved.
A lot of people that aren't in there that I really think should be in there. My good friend who just passed away, Bobby V, he should be in there. Tommy James and Sean Dale should be in there.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's so many people from the 50s that aren't in there who really started rock and roll, you know, you think about it. But I think in the 70s, rock and roll became rock music. And it's like they look back at rock and roll like a different genre altogether than rock music, which, you know, is really silly because there would be no rock music without the original rock and roll. So
that's right.
Sometimes I think their choices are kind of off the wall, but, you know, that's just my opinion.
Well, I agree with you, and so do many, many people our age. A lot of the people who grew up with the music of the mid-60s to early 70s have a different opinion on some of these things, because we grew up with what I consider to be the best music there ever was.
Well, I agree, yeah. It sure has lasted a lot longer than most of it, and it seems to hold up. You know, the records were done spontaneously in a lot of ways, in a lot of respects, and from the heart. There were a lot of music people in the business then. I call them music men. It's like my manager, Bill Lowry. You know, he was a music man. He was a what they call a song man. You know, he'd look for great songs. And I don't know if we have that anymore. It's a totally different ball game today. And I think media has become the star instead, or the technology has become the star instead of the artist in some respects.
Well, you're right, especially with some of the newer music. It's not very good. One of the things in your book that really, I want to emphasize it, that's why I wanted to save it to the end, because I think it's so important, and nowadays maybe even more important. After 1972, it has to be noted that you didn't have any chart hits. But what you write in the book was a very interesting line. I learned a lesson. Freedom of speech is only acceptable if your opinion coincides with those who make the rules. So true, and even more true today, where PC stuff is just off the wall. You actually came out and endorsed Richard Nixon.
I did,
and that might have been the death knell for the career of Tommy Roe.
Well, it certainly didn't help in Hollywood. And, you know, anytime an entertainer endorses a politician, they're setting themselves up for a possibility of disappointment. I mean, if you might be disappointed if they lose the election. You could be disappointed if they don't fulfill their promises or if they misbehave in office, you know, like Richard Nixon did. I was very disappointed with that, as most of the people who supported him were.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's very relevant to today, really, because you look at all the A-listers that supported Hillary Clinton in this election. I mean, they're devastated, and they can't believe it, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's part of the price you pay for participating in our system. And if you're not willing to pay that price, you should keep your mouth shut, you know?
Well, what they've done, though, so they've taken that loss, and now all these A-listers are out there just bashing the President of the United States.
Yeah, because they're angry, you know. Yeah. Listen, when Nixon did what he did, I was angry, too. I was very disappointed. But one thing you don't find the conservatives doing is making a big brouhaha out of their disappointments or their failures. I don't know why that is. Maybe it's because we're conservatives. I don't know. But, you know, listen, I wasn't happy when Barack Obama was elected president. His philosophy doesn't agree with mine. But, you know, he was my president. And, you know, he did a lot of things that I agreed with. But the left seems to just take it to the extremes. I don't know why they do that. I mean, you know, let's face it. Donald Trump can rub you the wrong way. There's no doubt about it. With his verbiage and stuff he says. But
absolutely.
Listen, he's our president. Give him a chance. Let him see what he can do. Maybe he can turn things around.
Yeah, I have a real problem, and it's a problem now that wasn't around during the 72 time when you were there. And that was the press being so hostile to this incoming president and publishing stuff that isn't true. And it just seems to me to be completely upside down. And it's very hard for people out there to actually believe what they read anymore.
Yeah, I agree. Well, you know, there's no money in peace. You know, there's only money in agitation and disagreement. And so I don't know how we got to this point. You have Fox News and CNN, totally different opinions on things. But, you know, we all want the same thing as Americans. We want good schools. We want good jobs. We want good environment. Republicans are no different than the Democrats in that respect. The difference is, how do we get there? That's what we should be discussing and debating, not our differences,
yeah.
You know. But you know, it's the way it is. It's not, some things never change. It's the way it was in the 60s and 70s, too. You know, I love John Kennedy. I'm a conservative, but I love John Kennedy. I loved, our president from Georgia, Jimmy Carter. I loved him. He's a good man. He's a decent, you know, well-meaning guy, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not so much you're Democrat or Republican. It's first we're Americans. Then we're Democrats. And we're Democrats who happen to be black or who happen to be Asian or who happen to be Indian or Italian. It shouldn't be Asian Americans, black Americans, white Americans. We should all be Americans.
I agree with you, Tommy Rowe. I do. You know, are you still performing? And if you are you going to be around the East Coast at all?
I'm doing about 10 or 15 dates a year, and we're doing an evening with Tommy Rowe. I'm really enjoying what I'm doing now, because I'm doing a Q&A in the show with the audience, and they're intimate venues, so I can really, you know, 500 to 1,000 people, and so I can really get up close and personal with the fans, and so it's very enjoyable. I'm working with my band that I worked with for so many years, and we're having a good time, so as long as I can keep it going, we'll keep on trying. I like to joke, I can jump as high as they ever did. I just can't stay up as long. that's kind of where I'm at right now in my career, but I'm having a good time.
Tommy, do you write anything political at all? Do we get an Eve of Destruction coming out of you sometime? Or?
Well, I wrote a song called Devil's Soul Pile, which is kind of social commentary, so to speak. This is a song that the title came from my childhood. My mom and dad used to take my brother and I to these evangelist tent meetings where you'd have like a tailgate situation in a field or a parking lot. You'd have a tent set up where preachers would preach all day, you know, in the tent. And mm-hmm. I remember going to this one tent meeting, and I was sitting there with my brother, and this preacher kept talking about the devil as a collector of souls, you know. And you got to the point to where it was so vivid to me. I pictured this devil kind of baling souls like hay, you know, on a wagon. So this stuck with me, and I had this thought in my mind, and I went fishing with a friend of mine up in the High Sierras a few years ago, and we were driving to the lake to where his favorite fishing hole, and we came upon this road sign that's called Devil's Post Pile, and it's a town up in the Sierras where it's kind of a tourist attraction. They have these rock formations in the side of a mountain that look like telephone poles. So people come to see this. It's like ancient, you know, it happened years ago in the formation of the earth. So when I saw that sign, Devil's Post Pile, boom, I got my tie off, Devil's Soul Pile. And because, you know, I was thinking back, I'd file that thought away. And when I saw that sign, it gave me my title. So I started writing the song, and I didn't know exactly what to write about. It was kind of so different from my normal genre, you know, it was the bubblegum genre. So I wrote a social commentary on crime in the cities, you know, and young kids growing up without fathers and the consequences of that, you know, of that mm-hmm. environment, what kids, the trouble kids can get into with not having a good family environment. But in the end of the song, everything works out because they find faith and they pull themselves out of the quagmire of street justice and do something with their lives. So that's about as close to political I've got in my songwriting, but it's I'm very proud of the song, and it did quite well in the independent charts. When I released it, it went to number one in the independent charts. So.
Well, people can check that out as well online. I just want to tell people to go to TommyRowe.com. There's some great pictures there, especially that are worth looking at. And this book is great. It's called From Cabbage Town to Tinseltown and Places in Between by Tommy Rowe with Michael Robert Krikorian. It's available on Amazon, and also, can you get it on TommyRowe.com as well?
Yeah, TommyRowe.com is autographed copies. I'll autograph
there you
it.
Go.
Get it to you. So Amazon is just a copy without an autograph. Unless you come to one of my shows with it, I'll be happy to autograph it for you.
See, I have a copy without an autograph myself, but that's all right. I got to talk to you, so I'm even happier. I don't care.
There you go, Mark.
Yeah.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much.
It's great to talk to you, Tommy, and hope we can do it again.
Absolutely.
All right. Take care.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.